This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyus Wuhib in Washington, and here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
When you have a severely malnourished child, and he gets a disease like malaria and measles, it's really a death sentence for that child.
That's World Health Organization spokeswoman Fadila Chaib on the problem of severe acute malnutrition in Ethiopia's Tigray region. Details coming up. Also, former rivals, Ivory Coast President Alassane Ouattara and former President Laurent Gbagbo, finally meet face to face. All these and more ahead on African News Tonight. We start with our top story. Soldiers from Botswana, South Africa, and Rwanda are in Mozambique to help quell an insurgency in northern Cabo Delgado province. Extremists loyal to the Islamic State or IS terror network have been launching attacks in the underdeveloped region since October 2017. The conflict left an estimated 3,000 people dead and 800,000 displaced. But despite the recent troop deployments, some analysts say African authorities are not taking the continent's terror threats seriously enough. Darren Taylor reports.
With the emergence of IS Mozambique, there are now terrorist insurgencies in all major regions in Africa. The African Union Center for the Study and Research of Terrorism says the continent suffered almost 1,200 terrorist attacks in the first 8 months of 2020, up almost 20% from the same period in 2019.
That is unimaginable, and it certainly indicates a worrying, growing trend.
International relations professor Suzanne Graham of Wits University in Johannesburg is studying Africa's burgeoning terror threat. She says half of the 20 countries globally that experience terrorism regularly are in Africa.
We have the AU, which is a very valid, credible body that is driving for us responses to threats on the continent, but perhaps not well enough or not able to do this sufficiently well enough because of the advancing trend that we see. So there are aspects at play here.
At times, says Graham, the AU seems unable to do much to stop terrorism.
If we have an AU, African Union in place, if we have the African Standby Force, the Peace and Security Council architecture all there, at least on paper, why is it that we're not able to be proactive and use early warning systems in place to really address problems before they happen, before they become major emergency threats and lives are lost?
The AU didn't respond to requests from VOA for comment. Graham says the organization appears to rely on the United States, European Union, and the United Nations for help in acting against groups such as IS. And a deep probe is needed to establish why the AU can't take charge of its own security. Part of the problem, says Graham, may lie in Africa's colonial past. She points out that terrorism remains a sensitive and provocative word for many Africans.
We know across the continent's history that many so-called terrorists were actually liberation movements, freedom fighters in the true sense of freedom for human rights across the continent. And they were labeled terrorists. And in fact, the ANC was considered to be terrorists well into the 1990s by the US State Department, despite being the first democratically elected government in South Africa.
At the moment, says Graham, the AU responds to terrorism using multiple ad hoc force deployments, such as the one currently underway in Mozambique.
And they, although useful, in my view, tend to detract slightly from a single African focus by states to fine-tune a structured response to terrorism that is a holistic response, that is a continental response, as opposed to regional responses.
She says if Africa is to successfully confront what will be one of its major challenges in years to come, it's imperative that it cooperates to establish a single, coordinated response to terrorism. Graham says the continent must make sure it's in a position to collectively respond to emerging terrorist attacks as soon as they happen, instead of allowing them to fester and grow. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Tunisia's Islamist al-Nahda party is calling President Kais Saied's suspension of parliament a coup and urging a broad dialogue, while other political parties and leaders appear divided on his actions. A number of trade syndicates, including the Labour Federation, say they support the move so long as it does not last more than a month. The president said he remains committed to civil liberties and the democratic process, and he has said the freeze of parliament will be temporary. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi discussed the latest developments in Tunisia with William Lawrence, professor of political science at the American University in Washington.
First, one elected official in Tunisia is preventing all other elected officials from doing their jobs, which is unprecedented in a democracy and unsustainable. Second of all, it can't be a coup and a dialogue at the same time if the dialogue produces the result that isn't a coup, right? So there's quite a few reasons you could call this a coup, among the fact that the military prevented the Speaker of Parliament from accessing his office, and the fact that press offices and journalists have been prevented by police from reporting on the power grab, and the clear indications that UAE, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt are actively encouraging a full-blown coup against democracy. But Nahda Party and many others are wise to pursue dialogue rather than just seek to violently or by massing a lot of people in the streets to simply oppose the president. For dialogue to succeed, the majority of the Tunisia parliament who are against the president, including the four largest political parties, are banding together in a united front to propose political solutions to the crisis, which was caused entirely by the actions of the president. If they succeed, Tunisian democracy will succeed. Of the 12 leading parties in parliament, only one is openly supporting the president, and they only have 15 seats. In terms of the population of Tunisia, there are three sets of supporters of the president. There are those who are extremely frustrated with Tunisia's failure to control the pandemic. Tunisia has the worst outbreak in Africa now, and one of the worst in the world, with death rates approaching that of the United States, which has a population 30 times the size of Tunisia. Second, there are a lot of young, frustrated people who can't find work, who believed the revolution would bring economic prosperity, and they want some sort of radical change to get jobs. And third, there are the counter-revolutionary forces supported by Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and UAE, opposed to any role for a Muslim Democratic Party in politics. What really will matter next, though, is what the labor union and the military do. So far, the labor union is trying to play the same mediating role that they played in the 2013 crisis, and it seems that they could have some success, as happened in 2013 when the parliament was shut down in a similar manner after political violence. And then the military was deployed around the parliament, but they really would prefer to be neutral. And so the United States and others are actively talking to the Tunisian president, the labor union, the military, to try to help tamp things down and promote this dialogue and keep the military neutral. And if all those things happen, then we could have a positive outcome. But this is the worst crisis Tunisia has seen since 2013.
The president met with political and trade union leaders to discuss the next move amid calls by some for a well-defined roadmap, and Saied told Tunisian rights groups that he remains committed to civil liberties and the democratic process, and he has said the freeze of the parliament will be temporary. Would the Tunisian civil society be able to press for a clear roadmap and to maintain transition to democracy in Tunisia?
Well, they can definitely press for that roadmap, and the efforts are already underway to make that happen. The president did manage to prevent parliament from meeting physically, but because of the pandemic, they have a virtual conferencing ability that they've been using. So the parliament's been meeting illegally, virtually, in order to make these moves to create a roadmap and to maintain that transition to democracy. But whether they succeed, we just don't know yet. The president did try to fire all of the elected mayors of Tunisia, some of whom openly mocked him because he has no right to do that. He also tried to begin prosecutions of 64 members of parliament, which his constitutional advisors told him he can't do as president. He also put the army in charge of pandemic response and then fired the defense minister, clearly not understanding that the army really can't, you know, be the institution that's dealing with the health crisis. What the democratic forces are going to have to do is acknowledge their failures on the pandemic and on the economy and lay out plans to address both of those and then agree to elections in the relatively near future.
That was William Lawrence, professor of political science at the American University in Washington, speaking with my colleague Mohammed Al-Shenawi. The World Health Organization warns that millions of people in conflict-ridden Tigray in northern Ethiopia lack access to basic health care and risk falling ill. The agency has been able to reach only a fraction of them. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
According to the WHO, about 3.8 million people in Tigray need health assistance. The agency wants to scale up its health services to assist at least 2.3 million this year, but only 87,000 have been reached since May 1st. WHO spokeswoman Fadela Shaib says lack of cash and fuel, limited access, insecurity, and depleted medical stocks are some of the many obstacles hampering WHO's life-saving operation.
What we are most concerned with is the fact that it's the season for cholera, and cholera is a problem in the region. Measles, malaria, providing health care for people who are injured from the current conflict, and also people who need health, for example, pregnant women, lactating women, children with vaccination, all these are very urgent needs.
A couple of months ago, a first round of an oral cholera vaccination campaign reached more than 2 million people out of the 4 million targeted. Shaib says holding a second round is key to reaching more at-risk people. Shaib, however, says the campaign cannot happen if the WHO is unable to get enough vaccine supplies and maintain a cold chain to store the doses. This, she notes, is difficult because access to electricity is often unavailable and fuel stocks are dwindling. Shaib notes multiple cases of violence or threats of violence against aid workers are hampering efforts to take actions to respond to diseases of epidemic potential, including cholera, measles, malaria, and COVID-19. Another problem of deep concern is the rising level of severe acute malnutrition in the Tigray region. In the first 2 weeks of this month, Shaib says 458 severely acute malnourished children were admitted to stabilization centers for specialized care.
When you have a severely malnourished child, and he get a disease like malaria and measles, it's really a death sentence for that child. We have 92 stabilization centers previously in place, but there are only 23 who are operational now, 200 more would be needed to address the health risk of malnutrition.
Under these circumstances, WHO says restoring health services is extremely challenging. It says health facilities have been damaged, equipment looted and destroyed, and essential medicines are lacking. Additionally, it says many health workers no longer are available because they are not being paid and face dangers from the prevailing chaotic conditions. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
As South Africa gains momentum towards its target of 35 million COVID vaccinations by December, debate is raging on the rights of those who do not want a jab. President Cyril Ramaphosa has said no one will be forced to be vaccinated, but experts and unions do not entirely agree on what this means. Tusoko Manlo reports from Johannesburg.
Currently, over 200,000 people are being vaccinated daily, approaching the government's goal of 300,000 per day. Close to 7 million people have received at least the first dose. But the fulfillment of this dream could be the tale of being so close yet so far. and vaccines activists are growing in number. This is one of them who prefers to remain anonymous.
It's fear-mongering, over and over, the same fear-mongering. We want a new narrative. They're saying the same stuff from last year. We want new narrative. We want to say, this is the solution. Only thing they say is, vaccine, 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 vaccine. We want other options, President, please.
But workplace vaccination guidelines gazetted by the Labour Department has left a window for compulsory vaccination. It enables employers to draft vaccination policies based on the kind of work an employee does, the risk of transmission they pose, and possibilities of still allowing an employee to work from home. Tipo Zana is an occupational health and safety inspector at the department.
It's up to the employer who needs to do the assessment of his or her workplace. So if they decide that for their particular type of work that they do, they are then going to move with vaccinations, then that is what's going to happen.
But unions are having none of it. Sizwe Pamla is the spokesperson of the Congress of South African Trade Unions. He insists that the constitution protects workers from forced vaccinations.
Our constitution allows people under Section 12 to have the right to bodily integrity, but also freedom of religion. So there are constitutional grounds for people to object to a vaccine, but there are also medical grounds. I mean, some people are allergic to some components of the COVID-19 vaccine.
Pamela says employers have many options.
You can accommodate employees to work outside of ordinary hours. As they are doing now, I mean, workers are not vaccinated and they are wearing a 95 mask. So you can allow that individual to continue to wear a 95 mask.
However, labor consultant Tony Hill says where employers have no way of accommodating an employee without a health risk to others, they could be justified if they dismiss the worker for refusing to vaccinate.
Where there's a high risk of infection and transmission, that employer would absolutely be entitled to make vaccination compulsory. They would, of course, still need to go to great lengths to see whether this employee could be accommodated elsewhere.
With no test case available so far, some experts warn forced vaccinations could open a floodgate of legal challenges that could disrupt the government's vaccination goals. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Cameroonian authorities are urging the public to get vaccinated against COVID-19 following a U.S. donation of 300,000 Johnson & Johnson doses yesterday. Cameroonians can now choose from the Chinese Sinopharm, Oxford AstraZeneca, and Johnson & Johnson jabs, but vaccine hesitancy remains high. Bokirwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Just 10 civilians have visited the BMRC hospital in Cameroon's capital Yaoundé today to be vaccinated against COVID-19. Among them is Olivia Forby, a 38-year-old vegetable seller. Forby says she wants the Johnson & Johnson vaccine she heard about from Cameroon State Radio.
I've learned that Johnson & Johnson is more than 75% effective in stopping the spread of coronavirus. And secondly, you take it in one dose. Sinopharm and AstraZeneca, you take in two doses. You spend more time going for the second dose.
On July 21, President Joe Biden announced the U.S. was shipping 1.3 million vaccine doses to Africa. Cameroon, Central African Republic, Gambia, Lesotho, Niger, Senegal, and Zambia are the 7 beneficiaries. Mary Dashbash is in charge of mission at the U.S. Embassy in Yaoundé. She says she handed over 303,050 Johnson & Johnson COVID-19 vaccines to the government of Cameroon on Monday.
We don't want to see people dying in Cameroon from the variant that is raging throughout the rest of the world. We've seen what it's done in Indonesia, we've seen what it's done in Tunisia, and we see what it's doing in the United States with people who have chosen not to get vaccinated. It's very important. The vaccine is effective at preventing people from dying.
Dashbach said she was hopeful the 303,050 doses donated by the United States of America will save 303,050 lives in Cameroon. Manauda Malashe is Cameroon's health minister. He says civilians should consider Johnson & Johnson as another life-saving vaccine. He says he is very grateful to the American government and its people for making it possible for Cameroon to have a variety of COVID-19 vaccines. He says he is pleading with people from 18 years and above who are still reluctant to be vaccinated to rush for either the Johnson & Johnson, Sinopharm, or AstraZeneca vaccines and save their lives. Cameroon has received more than 1 million doses since April, but less than 25% of the vaccines have been dispensed. Aliru Bashiru is a 24-year-old cattle seller who has refused vaccination. Bashiru says he prefers local remedies Cameroon government has officially introduced to stop the spread of COVID-19. He says people should trust African healers' remedies and stop believing that all solutions to their health problems must come from America or Europe. This month, Cameroon approved the sale of a herbal remedy from Samuel Kleda, a Roman Catholic bishop in the Central African state. The government said the recipe is supplementary aid to fighting coronavirus infections and was not a cure for COVID-19. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
More than 10 years after their rivalry spilled into a bloody civil war, Ivory Coast President Alassane Ouattara and former President Laurent Gbagbo have finally met as part of efforts to ease political tensions in the country. According to Reuters, as the two came face to face, Ouattara told Gbagbo, "I am happy to see you." The civil war that killed more than 3,000 from 2010 to 2011 was sparked after Gbagbo refused to concede electoral defeat to Ouattara. Gbagbo was later arrested and sent to The Hague. He returned to Ivory Coast in June after the International Criminal Court acquitted him of war crimes. Ouattara has officially welcomed Gbagbo's return, hoping it will ease tensions in the country. In the run-up to the recent election, scores of people died in clashes with police. Ouattara won a landslide victory, although the credibility of the vote was undermined by an opposition boycott. Here's a quick roundup of some of the action at the 2020 Tokyo Olympics. South Africa bagged its second silver medal in the Tokyo Olympics after swimmer Tatyana Shoemaker came second behind gold medal winner Lydia Jacobs of the USA in the women's 100-meter breaststroke final. Ivory Coast advances in men's soccer by eliminating Germany with a 1-1 draw today. The Germans won silver at the 2016 Rio de Janeiro Games. In women's soccer, Zambia bowed out of the tournament after its second loss to Brazil 0-1. The D-Tigers from Nigeria started their Olympic women's basketball campaign with a 72-81 loss against the favorite USA team in the women's opener in Group B yesterday. In men's basketball, Germany used a 14-0 run in the final minutes to pull away and beat Nigeria 99-92 yesterday. Both teams will finish their round robin Group B scheduled on Saturday. Nigeria faces Italy and Germany takes on Australia. And in the men's rugby sevens, South Africa placed fifth with a 28-7 victory over the United States. And Kenya was in ninth place after beating Ireland 22-0. Fiji took the gold medal with New Zealand taking silver and Argentina snagging the bronze. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. Thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.